Dear friends, this is Christoph, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to our podcast, Learning from Leaders. Today, we are in the beautiful mountains of Switzerland, high above the Lake Geneva, and I'm together with a person which will have a lot to share about human resources, about artificial intelligence, and what it really means to be human. I'm here today with Phil. Phil, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you are super busy.
It's my pleasure. It's lovely to be here.
It's just a dream, actually. Outside, it's beautiful. We can see the mountains. Let me introduce you to the audience. Obviously, you work since 2008 for one of Switzerland's most renowned organizations. You joined Tetra Pak in 2008, and you serve today as the Group Human Resource Officer for Tetra Laval and as the Executive Vice President Strategy, Human Resource and Transformation for Tetra Pak. And to put a couple of numbers to that, you and your team are responsible, I believe, for about 34,000 people working around the world.
Correct, yeah.
I know you since a couple of years, and this podcast, as we have discussed, Learning from Leaders, is of course to learn for you as a professional, but also to see a little bit behind what we normally can maybe perceive and really learn from your ups and from your downs. And I know you had tough times. For all these years, I've known you in great health, the shining, smiling Phil, which I see in front of myself, but I know you have gone through tough times. I'm so happy that you're well again. How are you doing today and now?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yeah, no, it's nice to be back. I went through my treatment and recently got the news that all looks good. So very happy to be back and full of energy.
I'm so happy for that. And for me, it's quite of kind of remarkable, right? You say it was so interesting and you shared that you acted very calm. That's a situation where we can easily lose it, right? We can be in despair. Was it really so that you kind of just realized I'm calm in this crisis? Or did you have to search for that inner calm to find that resilience?
I think I'm probably better with the big things in life than the small things in life. No, I felt calm throughout, really. I think that's because of a few different things. I mean, one is, you know, this is when you find out about your support systems and the relationships. So I've been blessed with a wonderfully supportive wife and my children and fantastic colleagues at work, a great boss, great medical support. First thing is that if that support system is intact, that's incredibly both reassuring, but also it makes you feel very good. Second thing is that I think probably one of my traits is that I'm a very grateful person. I don't take much for granted. I don't really have any kind of victim mentality. I never felt, that's unfair or what bad luck. It was more kind of reflecting on all the great things that I've had the privilege to do in my life. And what will be will be. So let's try and make the right decisions and maximize the chances, let's say. So no, I felt quite calm. Yeah.
That's remarkable. And I guess though, there must have been moments where you felt really tired. I think that's part of that disease, which is hitting so many of us. Where do you take your energy from? You said that there's a support system, there is that sense of gratefulness. Are there other places you go when you need energy?
Yeah, for me, there are a few things that are really important in my life. You know, one is I absolutely love reading. So whenever I was able to, reading was a great source of comfort. When I was able to walk, I love getting outside in amongst nature and the green things that heal us and under the sky. And so I always tried to take the opportunities when I was up for that. So yeah, these are the things I would say that kept me going. I think also knowing that things were in good hands at work, that my team was utterly reliable and taking care of business. So yeah, I'm very grateful to them.
And so you sustained yourself through that period, you got the news, you're healthy again. Now, are you looking at life differently? Is there something that you have learned that you would say has changed you forever? In that sense, your perspective, because you have looked in the eyes of death in a way that maybe we should all do, right? Because in a couple of years, I also will be gone. It could be a couple of days. We never know when it happens, but we know it happens to all of us. And yet we sometimes manage to kind of put that to the side and leave as we would be living forever. Has that changed something in you?
Yeah, it's been interesting. So the first thing I think is that I realize that, you know, my bucket list is not very long. I've had a chance to do a lot of things on my bucket list. And probably one of the things I've learned is that's a good thing to do. Don't save them all up for retirement or right. something like that. Making sure you're taking those. One other thing that I've probably learned is that because life is very transient and you sort of feel it more intensely, as you say, make sure you savor the moments. Don't rush through everything. You know, there's a lot goes on in, particularly in the world of business these days. And there are moments where you need to celebrate, moments where you need to savor things, moments where you need to enjoy, moments where you need to find time to pause. And this consciousness of moving through time is stronger than ever before.
I think that aspect of pausing is so vitally important in that time that is changing faster than ever, right? Many say the world will never ever change as slow as it is today. And we do a lot of assessments actually of teams. And that aspect of pausing is usually that aspect which scores the lowest in all dimensions that are important for a team's resilience, right? Because we keep on running, appreciating that very moment. And I think what inspires me also from what you say is that idea of ticking off a couple of things from that bucket list even right now. We might not be able to do it later on. Now, you know, in preparation of that podcast, I was also reflecting on moments where I was sick. And a moment that was, for me, surprisingly intense was about 1.5 years ago, where I had first COVID, and then it stayed for a couple of weeks. And there was that idea of long COVID. And in these moments, I really, which are rare for me, luckily, touch wood, because I have been blessed with a good health in the last 20, 30 years. But in these moments, I kind of ask myself, where is this energy actually coming from? What makes me human? Because something is missing right now. And I think that's another aspect of this podcast today. You have dedicated your life to human resources. So what makes us human in a world which is now getting dominated by artificial intelligence? That's something I wanted to ask you. What makes us human?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think we are creatures, and AI is a tool, a very sophisticated tool, but it's a tool. And what do creatures have? Creatures have a whole history. Creatures have a story. Creatures need to acquire things like food, so they have longings. They have emotions that are connected to those longings. They have to have intelligence so that they can achieve some of those things they long for. They have a craving for relationships. So for me, you know, being human is that combination of a history, a story, emotions, longings, connections, and of course, intelligence, or intelligences, we could even say. Yeah.
So in that sense, actually, intelligence is only one of many parts which makes us human. And when we talk about artificial intelligence and that idea of it replacing us step by step or in certain domains, it would be probably interesting to ask what other aspects of that humanness can artificial intelligence take over and which one not?
Yeah, I mean, I think because artificial intelligence is a man-made tool, if we can say it like that, what it can certainly replaces some kinds of intelligence, and not just replace, actually do much better than us. So obviously, if you think about the types of intelligence that are most connected with logical reasoning, numerical stuff, analyzing big bits of data, analyzing language now, these are capabilities that AI has. When you think about other intelligences, it's less clear. You know, emotional intelligence, perhaps some aspects of it, perhaps others definitely not, because that is more connected with things like story, relationships, which AI does not have. This is where I think we get sometimes into a category error. Artificial intelligence is a tool, very powerful, very sophisticated tool that's having a lot of impact and will have more impact. But it's not a creature that's going to replace humans. There is a lot of research going on AGI, so artificial general intelligence, which looks to try and link up some of these intelligences. But AI as it exists today is really, I think, an umbrella name for some very specific tools that have been created, which are very powerful. And some of those tools are generative tools. They can answer your question in a very quick way by structuring and filtering a lot of data. You can have tools that look and identify things. They can say, you know, does this radiological scan show cancer or not, for example. So very powerful, very useful tools. But I think we shouldn't confuse it with the Hollywood AI creatures and cyborgs that I assume are still quite a long way off.
Yeah. You know, during the COVID time, Microsoft published a study which was showing that we are now engaging in almost 250% of the amount of meetings we have been engaging before Corona, right? Back to back to back to back. And sometimes it seems to me that we are trying as a leader, as an employee, to out-robot the robots. And obviously, we will be second placed, if at all. It's a vitally important question to ask, in which aspects of our intelligence or of our way of being human do we need to invest now so that we can really differentiate us from others and remain relevant? I know that you have invested a lot of time in putting the focus to emotional intelligence in your human resource area. How do you place that? What is important moving forward?
Yeah, for me, I think if you look at the way humans will interact with and are interacting with artificial intelligence, I think there are different stages. You know, one is artificial intelligence can augment certain things that we do. So we do something and now we can do it a bit better because of AI. There are also some things that we're not needed for. AI can do that task better than us on its own. On the one hand, you have kind of the hype, and on the other hand, you have people saying it's not going to change anything. And it's neither of these polar opposites for me are true. So for me, it's a bit about this idea of complementing, augmenting. How do we fit these things together in good ways? For example, if we look at forecasting in our company, there are certain aspects of forecasting that artificial intelligence does much better than us. There are some where we know that a hybrid works better.
Okay.
And there are some where, today at least, it's much better to get it predicted by people. And so that trying to complement is very important. And then, as you say, you know, when you look at what can we each add to the equation of this augmenting or complementing, you know, what we can add is all the things that we talked about that creatures can possess that tools cannot possess, which is different kinds of intelligences, whether those are the emotional intelligences, the kinetic intelligences, the clever hands that are needed for certain things. We can add the sense of context, the sense of perspective that you cannot get if you haven't lived a life as a creature, judgment and so on. So finding the best ways without getting too stuck on certain principles, trying to be very practical about what works best together. For me, that's the way forward. And we should neither reject technology nor get subject to fantasies that are not really correct.
And that's interesting that you would say that you've realized quite many times these predictions are done better by human beings. And I think that aspect of connecting to an intuition, right, beyond available data, right, is something which is deeply human. Of course, even us as human beings many times cannot access it if we are stressed, for example. And therefore, that aspect of self-management, I would say, is more important than ever, so that we can bring that to the table. Would you agree?
Yeah, completely agree.
Yeah. Very practically speaking, you hold responsible for 34,000 people. That's an incredible responsibility. And I know how much heart and how much dedication and integrity you do that job. I have seen that over many years. With artificial intelligence coming in, were there tough choices? Were there cuts of jobs? Or is there a level of transformation which is sometimes painful now in your group? Or would you say that's not yet there?
For me, you know, technology has been changing work for decades, maybe even longer than decades. I don't see this as a different kind of thing. I had a discussion with our Works Council on this topic, European Works Council, and so, you know, in the 1800s, there was a job in the UK, in London, which was someone banging a stick on people's windows when it was time to start work. That job got replaced 150 years ago by alarm clocks. I don't see it as different. This is where I think sometimes by calling things AI and using this umbrella term, people start to lose perspective. We've been augmenting jobs, replacing tasks, and sometimes replacing jobs, whole jobs or collections of tasks, with technology for a very long time. And that process will continue. As that happens, jobs evolve and also other jobs are created.
Yeah.
And so demands for skills change, but this is what will happen. There was a very nice article recently. There was one of the AI researchers at Google 10 years ago basically said, don't train as a radiologist, because in 5 years, so 5 years ago,
yeah,
there will be no need. AI will have replaced radiologists. If you do that experiment today in the US, there are 490 radiologist jobs. That doesn't necessarily mean he's wrong, but what it means is people underestimate this interplay where you kind of, it augments a job. It slightly means the radiologist can spend some time on some other things and so on. So that's, that process will continue. And that process has happened in our company and in other companies. I don't see it as an order of magnitude difference from how technology has been changing our job. You know, I remember the days before email. And yes. I still remember one of my first experiences in a factory in the UK where my predecessor showed me this accounting double ledger paper book and told me that the task of planning the salaries would probably take me a couple of weeks, and he showed me all his versions of that. Of course, at that time Lotus 1-2-3 had come out, the precursor of Excel, and so something that was 2 weeks I was able to do in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
The next comment was, you'll need to get the secretarial pool ready for all the bonus letters, because it will take them a long time to put that. And then we connected Lotus 1-2-3 with a merge program for kind of WordPerfect. And that took not very much time at all. So that's no different in my view, that there were very significant changes of technology going on in the 80s, 90s. And I see this on the same kind of trajectory.
People are at times afraid, right, with ChatGPT coming in and in all these anticipations. I sense that you are not afraid and that you're sending a signal, hey, this is quite a normal journey. I love that idea of somebody walking around London, knocking at every door in the morning, and then maybe, you know, moving on to making watches and moving on from there. What do you sense? What are people afraid of, and do they need to be?
So I think there are good and bad reasons for being afraid. I think the fear of AI replacing humans for the reasons we've discussed,
yeah,
I don't think is a very realistic fear. There are some things to be afraid of. So I think, you know, whenever technology comes out, usually regulation is behind.
Yeah.
And I think that's the case for AI. And I think we're seeing a surge now in legislative activity around AI. And I think that's good, because AI, like any technology, has the capacity to be used for good things, like we've talked about, for augmenting radiologists' work. And it has the capacity to be used for very bad things. And then there are some things where we probably are not very good at predicting which way it will go. In my view, social media is one of those things where probably at the beginning the predictions were very positive and the experience is not turning out so positive in a number of important dimensions. And those things we should be concerned about. But then the question are we concerned about AI, or are we concerned about concentrations of wealth and power? And I think that is something to be concerned of, particularly as the raw material for a lot of, if you take ChatGPT, the raw material is produced by humans.
Yeah.
And it's not paid for but it's harvested with a profit incentive, which you can challenge whether that's the right societal setup for this, or whether there should be what some people call data dignity, where you have to create a value chain of data. For example, we don't anticipate the impacts of technology. A lot of us have given our data very freely and maybe sometimes getting a bit concerned about how that's used. There can be cause for concern, but not maybe where it is today, which is the, you know, it's going to replace us. My concern is more with, do we have the right regulatory framework around this new technology? And the usual answer is, not yet, because technology goes fast and regulation goes slower.
That's super interesting. You know, one of the concerns I have, what I foresee, is that it becomes more and more easier to manipulate us in our thinking, maybe also to divide society easier through social media, which is customized towards what we are already thinking of, or the sides we are already taking. To deal with that risk, I think it's so important that we use our full human potential, that we are aware of ourselves, that we can observe our own thinking, that we can assess our behaviors and our thinking processes, that we have also micro habits, maybe rituals, which connect us to our human nature again and again every day, while we are running and while we perform and while we do our jobs and take care of our duties. For me, for example, I love to start the day, I feel, every morning before I take breakfast, with a little bit of fitness. I do some breathing, I do some mindfulness. That's an anchor for me. At the other end of it, I typically come out fresher, with maybe a little bit more of joy and inspiration. I think for the audience, it could be very interesting. In your super busy daily routine, do you have such rituals which help you to connect? I know that you are an author, you have written books. I heard you play the piano. What helps you?
A few things, I think. One is playing music, because playing music, you know, I always think music is very soulful, you know, because you don't have the words. It sort of frees your mind. And coming home after a busy day and just playing piano, which if I'm at home is what I will do for half an hour, I find very peaceful. And I like the beauty. Beauty is quite important for me, the beauty of what the composer envisaged and trying to interpret that. A similar thing for me, I love poetry. It is then language, but it's a very pure form of language, and it's very, it's like nuggets, you know, very insightful, very touching, very moving, particularly lyric poetry. I enjoy that a lot. And then for me, I love being outside, you know. Okay. Nature is for me, because and particularly mountains. And one of the reasons I think for mountains is that it changes your perspective of the role of humans, because we spend our days thinking about humans or ourselves. And then suddenly you realize, okay, in the grand scheme of things, we are very small and we are very transient compared to this wonderful mountain that's been here for millennia. And I think that grounds you. Has that effect on me? It sort of grounds me, humbles me, and it gives you this kind of sense of perspective that whatever troubles you've been dealing with that day are really not, in the big scheme of things, are not very important. So that's the kind of thing that I really enjoy.
Yeah, and having that perspective is so important. I think typically when we worry, right, somehow life shrinks. I'm here and here's my problem, and I cannot perceive that magnitude of life. I also love playing music, and whenever I do that, I play the guitar, I have a sense of the music helping me to move from the head to the heart. And that probably also differentiates us from the artificial intelligence, right? That aspect of feeling, transcending, connecting to an aspect which is probably not accessible through logic, but so human and so vitally important for our experience of life. You have had an exceptional business career, a career which allowed you step by step to develop yourself, very sustainable development as a leader. Tetra Pak is an organization which has developed very sustainable. And I think that, in contrast to a scenario out there where organizations live shorter and shorter. So back in 1920, the average lifetime of an organization was some 67 years. Now we seem to be down to 15 years. There's a lot to learn from you as a leader and from Tetra Pak as an organization. What would you say are, let's say, the most important ingredients of a sustainably successful business career or building a sustainable organization?
In both cases, it's being clear on who you serve and how you serve them then. Because I think there are many stakeholders of an organization like Tetra Pak. There are customers who absolutely rely on us. There are food value chains that rely on us. There are employees who rely on us. There are governments and societies that have expectations of us. There are suppliers that rely on our orders to keep their businesses going. There are people who provide capital. There are people who provide labor. An organization is in this huge ecosystem and owes something to each part of that ecosystem. And being clear on that ecosystem, who you serve, and making sure that you reliably serve them is an incredibly important value for the long-term survival, I believe, of a company and also of a function within a company and an individual career. And I think it requires a lot of clarity, because otherwise you can get very confused by short-term financials, which cause you to make decisions which disenfranchise parts of that ecosystem. And I think that's really why, one of the reasons at least, that some companies fail is that they start to ignore important pieces of that ecosystem that have expectations of them, and kind of lose their right to operate as a consequence of that, and lose their ability to listen to these varied voices, which can be extremely useful and interesting. If I take the human resources function as an example, you know, we have to navigate a set of interests between employees, unions, works councils, managers, owners, etc. It's a balancing act which needs to be sustained so that everyone sees value in carrying on being part of that, because that's what then sustains it. And when you start to take sides or start to trade off things in an unreasonable way, you start to lose that ability to sustain the business, sustain your role. That's my view on what keeps companies sustainable, being attentive to that. There's a quote, and I've been trying to look for where it comes from, but I've not managed to succeed, nor has ChatGPT, which probably means I've remembered it slightly wrong. But it basically says, one of the persistent aspects of folly is not listening to the different voices around you. Yeah. And I think that's very true.
And listening to the voice for whom we actually started to build that business for our client, the customer, for example, is, I think, difficult the more an organization grows, because when you are at a size of 34,000 people, there are so many internal processes and so many people are busy just with that. They have to be busy just with that, and they have no direct contact with the customer. Living this principle to be sustainable is not easy. How do you put the customer at the forefront of what Tetra Pak is doing? Practically,
that is where our revenue comes from. So you either need to be able to connect what you're doing directly to a customer, or connect it to someone who's doing something for a customer. So for example, our processes, why are they there? They're there so that we can be very reliable in delivering to our customer what they expect from us. So try to rethink your processes from that perspective, rather than thinking of them as, I don't know, internal controls or bureaucracy. What helps us be a reliable supplier to our customers? Making sure that the customer is extremely visible in all that you do, in all your internal communications and so on. So I think this idea of connecting yourself to these other stakeholders that are required for success of, and not just success, but sustainable success.
Yeah.
Is absolutely key.
You said that predicting the future could be one of the aspects that artificial intelligence sometimes is not as powerful. You need to use that human intuition. And I would like to tap into your intuition to predict maybe in 10, 20 years. What do you think is important to sustain organization as we move forward?
For everyone, it's been quite an unusual few years. Of course, the pandemic, but then some consequences partly related to the pandemic, partly related to other things, which is some very uncertain supply chains, some inflation coming into the system, and geopolitics resurging, let's say. You know, I've had a lot of discussions with colleagues who think, you know, we're now entering a tougher period. And I think that is probably true. But I think the unusual period is the period before in world history. You know, if you think following, let's call it the fall of the Iron Curtain, yeah, and things like this, China opening up to trade. We've lived in some quite golden years, you know, the GATT negotiations, a lot less geopolitics. Of course, that's not been true for all parts of the world, but development has accelerated a lot during those years, really up until 2008, with the financial crash. It was kind of a golden period for global, yeah, business, in my view, which is unlikely to be repeated. Then it's got a bit more difficult since then, and obviously since 2020, quite challenging times. You know, my view is we're going back to maybe more normal conditions, which is higher inflation than the central banks would like, more focus on cost, more geopolitics, and probably more crisis, or what we perceive as crisis, like we have right now with transportation in the Red Sea. Yeah. And that's going to demand some leadership. And you know, there's a lovely quote from Warren Buffett, which says, it's only when the tide is going out that you see who's been swimming naked. And I think we're going to come into an era, yeah, where we're, yeah, going to see the resilience of our leaders, yeah, more clearly. Mm. Some leaders that were able to survive when the, yeah, tide was coming in are going to, yeah, find it more difficult. And I think things like resilience are going to become more important, yeah, as we assess and develop, particularly leaders, but all of us.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think resilience both on the individual level, but in particular also on a team level, right? Mm. And sometimes we would probably argue that, well, a team is basically the sum of the parts of the individual well-being or resilience. But yet, when we meet together, right, when you and me meet, there is an energy, there's a consciousness, there's something that is happening that is bigger than the sum of the parts. That energy, that consciousness is also vitally important to sustain through these possibly times when the tide is leaving. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is also where diversity and inclusion contributes a lot to that if you get it right. Yeah. If you have a team that has a lot of the perspectives that you would find in the outside stakeholders and all their different interests and different ideas, if you can replicate that inside your team and listen to it, which is the inclusiveness bit, then you can see the power, yeah, of that in the time that is coming. So, yeah.
You know, when we look at the business career of a leader from outside, then many times it looks quite linear, right? From success to success, and here you are with such a responsibility. But I think looking a little closer, I have come to understand that actually what makes a person successful is many a times exactly this resilience, that ability to stand up when we fall. And I wanted to ask you, were there moments in your career where you felt that's it? Where you basically kind of fell flat on the floor, it didn't go your way, and how did you kind of get back on your feet?
Yeah, a good example for me, you know, when I was, I think, 27, 28, I moved to the US in a role for another company, which was a very big manufacturing site and a very old manufacturing site, and we were not really competitive. And one of the things I was trying to do was to try and work with the union at the time and with the employees and with management to work out how can we collectively address this so that we can serve our customers. We have a lot of customers, for example, in the auto industry who are telling us, you're not competitive, and if you don't fix something, we're not going to buy from you. We had a lot of discussions and if I take examples, you know, how do you get more competitive? For example, we had very strict rules about who can do what. So if you're a plant operator, you cannot do any minor maintenance, because that's another job description, yeah, and that was enforced in the union agreements. But if we were able to do that, then we could be more productive, we could serve our customers better, and there are a whole series of examples like that. And I didn't succeed in that, and quite a few of our customers did stop buying from us, and so we had to go into a pretty massive downsizing. And this downsizing was extremely painful, because, you know, the people who'd spent their whole lives working for us, even, yeah, in some cases their parents had worked for us. And it was a totally demoralizing process, because the way we had to do it was each of us took 32 people a day. So it's a bit like that film with George Clooney.
Yeah.
So I arrive each day, security guard, 32 files, And I've got to get through those during the day, so 15 minutes. And whatever emotional state someone was in at the end of 15 minutes, next one. And this went on for months. You know, that was a thoroughly demoralizing experience and an example of what I think you were looking for there.
Yeah. You come in the morning, you have to sit with 32 people, giving them such a bad news. You go home, you feel depleted, come back the next morning. So if, looking back, where did you take your energy from?
By the way, going back home, to go past the police protection of my family.
So. And was that an ethical dilemma for you also?
It wasn't an ethical dilemma in the sense that I think we tried to address the issue which would have made us be more sustainable. And we had failed. So there wasn't an ethical dilemma. It was a disappointment in myself. In not having achieved it, but the consequences were clear. So it had to be done. But I learned a lot from that experience. I mean, one is, first of all, human beings react very differently in these circumstances. You could see every type of reaction under the sun. But it also taught me something about not telling stories. And what I mean by that is, you know, I have been very careful since that moment with anyone trying to tell the employees that this company is like a family. It is not like a family. It's an economic enterprise that serves an important societal purpose. But do not confuse this for a family. I want to be very straight with people that this is primarily an economic relationship. And then we hope there's lots of other good stuff as well. But don't lose sight of the fact that it's an economic relationship. And that's been quite important as a, if you extend that concept, don't try to make people feel better about things than things really are. Be straight, because then it's much easier, because I had a lot of people at that time say, you know, I was told this was a family and families wouldn't kick their... And I've been very careful since then to avoid those kind of statements.
And that's a very strong conclusion, because on one hand, we want to make it feel like a family, and that's probably fair, that's good. But with that then comes a set of expectations which you were not able to fulfill, right?
Correct.
And which at the end of the day, probably no organization can fulfill. But leaving the people in that belief is not fair, right, you would say?
I feel very strongly about promises. They should be very carefully made, and they should be on things where you believe that you have most of the control to make that promise. Otherwise, you should not do it, because someone else is going to build their decision process and their life around those promises. And then if you can't fulfill them, or your successors can't fulfill them, you've not enabled them to make the right decisions for themselves. And that is an ethical dilemma.
And what brought you through also is that sense of being candidly honest, saying it as it is and not sugarcoating it.
That's very important to me.
Which probably allowed you to build trust. And that's something I certainly can see around you, that people trust you. And that's amazing. And probably that has been one of the reasons that you have such an amazing career. Now, you know, amongst the viewers, definitely there will be people that feel, well, here's it's Phil. What an incredible career. I also feel I have a potential. There is something in me that is bigger than what I'm able currently to achieve. I would like to live my full potential. What would be an advice to you, maybe, the viewers out there, how to tap into that?
My reflection is that in life, we regret the things we don't do, not the things we do that we shouldn't have done. We regret some of those as well, but on balance, it's we regret the things we didn't have a go at. And so one of the things which I'm quite proud of is that I took a lot of assignments that no one else wanted. It might look strange now, but in the late 90s, I set off for China with one of my companies, and a lot of people said, you know, you're on a good track here, stay in the headquarters, why would you go over there, you know, we're not investing a lot right now, which sounds strange in today's terms, but in the mid 90s, companies were not investing a lot in China. At the time I arrived, the biggest investment in China was Motorola, who had made an investment in Beijing and Tianjin. And all I saw was opportunity. I just thought, what an exciting adventure to be in that part of the world at that time. The job that I just talked about, the manufacturing site. So I think one piece of advice would be take some risks.
Yeah.
Do some things. Don't rationalize to yourself why not to do them. And I also did many things. So I've had three jobs which involved a pay cut for that reason.
Yeah.
And I know that doesn't resonate so well with everyone these days, but it more than paid back over the career. Second thing for me is, where do you get your information from? Make sure you're reading lots of diverse stuff, or if reading's not your thing, podcasts or relationships, or but don't listen to one thing.
Yeah.
And don't get yourself caught up in echo chambers because you're destroying your own value. You need to be able to see lots of different points of view. This will help, I think, you get the most out of your career. And then the final advice I would pass on is something that was passed on to me very early in my career by a very wise man, Eric Paul. He said, career is about finding your smile. So go hunt it. And so I think that has stood me in good stead. You know, I've really enjoyed the vast majority of my career because it was something I believed in, something I wanted to be involved with.
Career is finding your smile, go hunt it. How beautiful. And for that, if it is a salary cut, so be it. If for that I take a risk, step into the unknown, so be it. And by your smile, I can feel that you have done that. My last question though, Phil, is if you would now meet maybe the Phil at the age of 20 or 25, and with all your life experience now, you could give him one advice, what would you tell him?
I'm going to give you two sides to sneak two in there. One is don't sweat the small stuff. I think I told you before in the beginning, I'm quite good at dealing with the big things in life, but sometimes I get lost on some of the small stuff. So I need to just let some of that pass over instead of getting into it all. The other would be about beauty and enchantment. This one life that we have is an incredible thing. And I can say that even more now through what I've experienced recently. Make sure it's an enchanting life. And make sure that somewhere along the way, young Phil, you enchant some other people.
Wow. So nice. I, Phil, can definitely say you enchanted me. I'm quite sure, and you can judge, you can put your comments that this conversation, that Phil's insight has enchanted you. I hope so. Thank you so much for taking the time. Phil, thanks for sharing so candidly, so open, so from your heart, what you have learned, what you have gone through. Again, I'm so happy to see you with that big smile here today. I wish you all the very, very best for what's to come.
Thank you, Crystal. Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And to all of you, thanks for being with us. If you enjoyed it, put your thumbs up. You can subscribe to the podcast and stay tuned. See you soon again.